Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. It is Tuesday, July 1st. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. Our science community is sounding the alarm about cuts to science proposed in the 2026 federal budget. We hear from the Astronomy Institute at the University of Hawaii. We talk state budget cuts here in Hawaii. The governor signed an executive budget bill yesterday. We learn what's been trimmed. And we pause to consider the origins of the Hawaii Tourism Authority, where the agency came from, and how the current overhaul can point it toward the future. And we read the tea leaves to find out why the governor signed a bill that ended up on his list of possible vetoes. What does it mean for the state's tea industry? You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The Trump administration's funding cuts have been deep to the budgets of NASA and the National Science Foundation, and there is more hand-wringing over the 2026 budget that lawmakers are in the process of marking up. Cuts would total roughly half of the budgets of the NSF and NASA, which is unprecedented. The United States telescopes stand to be hit especially hard under the proposed cuts. We sat down with Doug Simons, who's the director of the Institute of Astronomy at the University of Hawaii, to talk about the future of astronomy and research at the telescopes across Hawaii. From where you sit, based on what we know about the cuts to the Science Foundation and NASA, how does that affect your universe?
Potentially quite stark. Astronomy is one facet of the broader impact of these proposed cuts on science, essentially all of U.S. science, given the nature of funding at NIH and Department of Energy, NASA, NSF, et cetera. In our case at UH, particularly the Institute for Astronomy, roughly two-thirds of our annual budget is derived from NSF and NASA funding. We get about $10 million a year from the state of Hawaii, for which we're super grateful, and that provides funding for a lot of core positions. But we rely on NASA and NSF money for the bulk of our telescope operations, which fuels our research capacity and our education program in critical ways.
We did hear about the impact to the various telescopes around the state. What's your biggest fear?
I don't know if I could say it's just one, because there are so many proposed cuts. So quantified a bit, it's about a 40% proposed cut in the U.S. contribution to Gemini, which in practice, I think, because they have international partners, is about a 25% cut, effective FY26, which is huge. DKIST is looking at a similar level of cut, except they're funded solely by NSF, so a 40% cut is really going into the bone there.
And DKIST, that's the Daniel K. Inouye Solar Telescope there on Haleakala.
And that one particularly is alarming because they are just about to go into science operations. They've invested roughly $400 million to build an absolute state-of-the-art, one-of-a-kind solar telescope. And the notion of cutting essentially in half the budget, which I don't know if that's workable or not, but it clearly it's going to be a huge impact for those folks in that operation. So that one really struck me as a kind of a bizarre method for trying to cut costs, because you've just made this huge investment using 100% U.S. taxpayer money and then essentially hobbling that facility out of the starting blocks.
And when we last talked to the director, I believe they had a number of incredible proposals for research to use that telescope.
That's right, yeah. And they literally stand to do completely revolutionary type of research in astrophysics, with all kinds of applications. The Institute for Astronomy, we are under the arrangement that was negotiated years ago, we'd receive about 13% of the observing time at DKIST for our solar research team. The knock-on effect for us is large to our overall program, too.
We have heard concern by senior scientists, award-winning senior scientists, about the impact to the research that's just getting underway by young scientists. Because if they can't grow their careers with what they want to study, they may go elsewhere.
That's right. I'm certainly hearing through various channels what's been widely described as a brain drain, an export of expertise across all of U.S. science to countries and regions that aren't looking at these sorts of budget cuts and be more than willing to host the type and caliber of expertise we have in this country. Amongst the NSF proposed cuts is a huge number of cuts to the grants program for postdocs and graduate students. I think it's for the GRFP program, that's the largest of them at the NSF, looking at about a 50% cut. So that directly impacts the number of students that can be sponsored by the National Science Foundation, and a huge number of postdoc budgets were simply zeroed out completely. I'm very concerned about the impact on younger generation scientists, which of course has a knock-on effect when you look at the potential for their multi-decade careers and all their contributions they could be making if they had a normal start to their career pathway. But being limited right up front with these huge budget cuts has a long and lasting and potentially devastating impact to the field.
I had a conversation with someone last month whose program got their funding cut for STEM education for girls, for young women at university, the College of Education. Mm-hmm. And that person was scrambling to try and find alternate funds so they could keep that program going. But just to be able to nurture those minds that have great interest in science so that they can go on to things like study astrophysics and
exactly.
Anything else.
Exactly, yeah. This is amongst the most alarming aspects of what's going on. And I should remind everybody that even if these budget cuts aren't as severe as proposed, we've already lost a huge amount of talent within these federal programs at NASA and NSF. That expertise walked out the door either through terminations or incentives or budget cuts funding their positions. And it's going to take a long time to rebuild that level of management and scientific expertise in these absolutely essential federal operations at NSF and NASA. To some extent, no matter what happens with the FY26 budget, there's already been a lot of damage done in terms of managing whatever comes out of this process with budgets in the future.
The thing that is a head scratcher for many people is that the U.S. has been a world leader in space, and they worry that these cuts will hurt our standing, that we are in the great stratosphere right now, and that could change.
And it certainly will. If we have a number of programs proposed to be cut within NASA, missions that are proposed to be cut, and you're essentially undermining the futures of young scientists across the country. This is one of the great success stories of the United States over history, is that we've had such an incredibly successful university program working in partnership with the federal government with bipartisan support for essentially the entire duration of these programs. It's generally quite popular with what the government has been doing to sponsor this type of basic research, which fuels the economy at an incredible rate. As I said before in other interviews, I honestly don't know what problem we're solving with cuts to the bone of our research community, given the leveraging effect of that on the economy and the tiny amounts of money compared to what's trying to be removed from the overall federal budget. You know, you're talking about trillions of dollars there, but the impact on NASA and NSF of 50% budget cuts, which in real dollars is several billion dollars of cuts for NASA and NSF individually, that's a drop in the bucket for the overall budget situation in the government, but it is a huge crater for these programs to be able to try and navigate out of.
I worry about my neighbor's a child who got an internship at NASA and who just had this very bright future ahead. And I worry for him about what are the prospects out there when you see this kind of money getting cut. And we talked to someone at the med school, a researcher, who had said if there isn't this type of funding that's available through the Institutes for Health, he's looking at big pharma. So, you know, what can our astronomers do? Where do we look for another pot of money?
It's hard to say because we've had such a good and positive and successful arrangement already between universities and the federal government through NASA, NSF, and other related departments within the government. To some extent, philanthropy can help out, but they will never be able to backstop the billions of dollars that have been provided for decades now from the federal government. So that can soften the blow a little bit, but it's not a substitute. And at some level, it's going to be up to the folks in Congress to decide what's important and to realize that 50% cuts like that, those being proposed here, are going to have absolutely devastating consequences for basic research across the U.S. with knock-on effects that beyond the career impacts you're talking about, the economic impact over time will be just devastating.
Well, I was reading that one of our billionaires, Mark Zuckerberg, you know, is moving some of his foundation money towards science as opposed mm-hmm. to social services. Hopefully that's a good sign for you folks.
Yeah, you can certainly use the help given circumstances. And it's very much appreciated as well. But you have to keep in mind, everybody's facing budget cuts to some extent and looking to private money to backstop it. So I suspect there's a real surge of demand within the philanthropic community that is just going to overwhelm their capacity.
Anything else you want to say just about the science cuts and the decisions not to fund the 30-meter telescope on Mauna Kea, the decommissioning of another telescope up there on the Mauna?
Yeah, there's a lot going on, obviously, and a very complicated confluence of circumstances these days. As was announced a few days ago, we decided to go and decommission UKIRT up on the summit of Mauna Kea. And long story short, that basically is because I did not see a plausible path forward for financing operations beyond 2033, which is when the lease for that telescope and other telescopes in principle expires. We don't get new leases in place. As I said at the beginning of the interview, this is an astronomy-centric matter for me and others within the astronomy community here, but I think the general public should view it as a real risk to science in general, and particularly U.S. science, which has an effect that is incredibly pervasive and important for our country and our communities.
We have been talking with University of Hawaii's Institute for Astronomy Director Doug Simons. You're listening to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Uncertainty over federal budget cuts hangs over the state like a black cloud. Honolulu Civil Beat has a story today about the state budget bill signed by the governor. Politics editor Chad Blair joins us to talk about this. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of what happens there in the nation's capital affects us. So I was interested to see that he signed this bill because we were all waiting to see what wasn't going to get funded.
Right. The governor indicated a couple of weeks ago that he was looking at using his line item veto pen to go through and knock out things that maybe we shouldn't be paying for in the state budget because we may need that money depending on what happens with the federal government. Of course, that is really up in the air, but we saw what the Senate did this morning. There are significant cuts proposed for Medicaid, other programs, and we'll see what's going to happen. But essentially what the governor did yesterday is he approved the state's budget for the next 2 years. It's $40 billion, just about, total. But he did end up cutting some things, not as much as maybe was forecast, but he did excise about $110 million less than what had been approved by the legislature in the budget bill. That's House Bill 300. Of course, the session wrapped up in early May.
Yes, and some of those cuts affect public schools.
Yes, they do. And you know, remember the Department of Education, it's a huge expense to run the schools. We have a unified school system in the state. It's about $2.6 billion, that's B as in boy, $2.6 billion a year for the next 2 years. That's 2.6 for each of the next two fiscal years to run the Department of Education. This is not to say that there is fat there, but there is a lot of money, and most of this $110 million that the governor has excised from the budget will be coming from the Department of Education. It has to do with support services and operations. I did talk to someone in the governor's administration today that said some of it was deferred maintenance, and so that's money that they will not be getting. You might recall that the DOE has had some challenges spending down its CIP, right? It's capital improvement project money. That's been a bit of a backlog there. But they are taking the biggest hit compared to like the Department of Health also took a pretty good cut, $10 million. and has to do with mental health intake specifically. I checked. That's with the state hospital. So we'll see if we can learn a little bit more about that. But they took the biggest cuts. Then there were about seven other line item vetoes in addition to those two.
Yeah, and, you know, with the DOE, I know that, you know, we have been long grappling with, hundreds of millions in repair backlog, list that, that stuff needs to be done. If you're facing more immediate needs, I guess that's the thinking, right, that we can hold off on fixing these schools.
Yeah, although I wouldn't, it's such a big department. There's 260 schools or something statewide. And I should emphasize that the governor, it's interesting, in his press release yesterday, he didn't actually mention the line item vetoes. He just mentioned the dollar amount, didn't go into a lot of detail, almost as if he didn't want to play it up too much. Instead, he focused on what the budget is going to pay for, something which was already news, but that does include money for the schools. $30 million are going to go for electricity costs. We know that we have the highest electricity costs in the country. And then I did mention there might be some cuts in deferred maintenance, but there is still a $60 million going in regarding that. But it's such a difficult thing to parse through. Maybe you've looked at the budget worksheets and so forth. It's a complicated document to read. And we will probably be looking further into that to see how it's going to impact. Because, as you say, the Department of Education does seem to be taking some hits. But as you know, there's also been concerns about whether it's spending its finances, taxpayer money, properly.
Yes. And, the governor obviously wants to highlight the pluses, right, in that budget. I know there's some money that you wrote about for Maui wildlife recovery efforts, that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. It's big money. We're talking $12 million just for case management projects on Maui recovering for wildfire efforts, just $15 million for statewide highways fire mitigation. As you know, the grass grows and it's dry and people don't cut it, and that's where it often catches fire. Kalhali did well, $37 million for tiny homes. Biosecurity, $26 million to pay for some people to help eradicate those invasive species that are only growing in numbers.
Yeah, well, I know we often chuckle because it's like, we want to know what got cut, right? And he didn't really want to highlight that. But I'm sure we'll find out more in the days to come.
Yeah, and remember, there might be a special session later this year to deal with whatever happens at the federal level.
All right. Okay, well, thanks so much, Chad.
Thanks, Catherine.
That was Civil Beat's political editor, Chad Blair. You can read his story online at civilbeat.org.
Invited to play trivia with HPR Generation Listen on the first Tuesday of the month at Village Bottle Shop and Tasting Room in Kaka'ako. Test your wits, enjoy some friendly competition, and meet with fellow HPR fans. Generation Listen is an HPR initiative that connects young and young at heart listeners with the station and with each other. Learn more at hawaiipublicradio.org/genlisten.
Support for HPR comes from Costco Air Conditioning and Refrigeration, featuring Daikin air conditioning systems. Listing of contractors installing Daikin products, that's D-A-I-K-I-N, at CostcoHawaii.com.
You know, all this week, we're turning the spotlight on the Hawaii Tourism Authority. Now that the agency is officially back under the Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism, and no longer a quasi-separate agency, HTA became a separate entity in 1998, almost 30 years ago, under Governor Ben Cayetano. The idea was born from a task force that he assembled to lift Hawaii's economy out of the doldrums. We talked to the governor earlier this morning about those origins.
The committee was called the ERTF, Economic Recovery Task Force, and it was made up of people from business, labor, all the different parts of the community. And the idea of the HTA was born, and the focus or the purpose was to market Hawaii tourism in ways that were more purposeful and organized.
And those early days when you folks were trying to create the structure and the framework so that you'd get representation on that authority, what was the thinking?
I think an integral part of the thinking or the strategy was the marketing should not be pure marketing in a sense that you just put up a TV or radio ads and do it the way it was done in the past. The committee just strategized, and there was a lot of money involved, and we tried to keep the board of directors as objective as possible, which meant that the intent was not to load it up with people from the hotel industry, for example, or the airlines, but to have a more broad representation of people from the business community as well as the community at large. Unfortunately, over the years, it strayed from that purpose or that objective.
And there have been lots of criticism in recent years. The legislature tried to defund it because it wasn't really happy with the direction and thought there should be more management and less emphasis on the marketing.
I don't think it was less emphasis on marketing. It was finding ways to market more effectively and maybe more diversely. For example, one of the things that the HTA funded was, I think it was about $4 million for the movie Lilo and Stitch. And we were criticized for that. But the thought was that movie is going to be playing for 50 years. And if it advertises Hawaii, that's effective way to spend money. And what's happened, of course, is they're making a second remake of that movie, been very, very successful. So for people who saw the movie all over the world, for $4 million, Hawaii was able to show itself, expose itself in terms of the scenery. And I think in the first movie, there was some caption or something that advised the viewers that this was being done with the funding from the HTA or the Visitors Bureau. That's the kind of marketing that was never done before. And it required a little thinking out of the box. And I think that's what we thought should be explored. We were very concerned about overrepresentation on the board by members of the hotel industry, for example, or the airlines. And soon what happened was, and this always happens when there's a lot of money available, non-tourist people who were appointed to the board were all of a sudden being recruited by the hotels and the airlines and offered jobs. So that kind of got away from the objectivity that we had hoped to see on the board.
Given that we had so much vested in HTA and this structure and this model, do you agree with the governor's assessment that he needed to pull it back under DBED and state control?
Well, you know, there are two sides to that coin. On the governor's side, people voted for him. I'm sure he expressed his hope and aspirations for Hawaii tourism. And he told the people what he wanted to do. On the other side, you want some, you want diversity. But the way the board has been going now, I think that you find that it's been pretty much taken over by certain groups. And so I would, at this particular point, I would support that the control going to the governor. Now, having said that, the governor himself may be catering to pressure from the hotel industry or the special interest groups, which in my opinion are trying to control the HTA. But then people know exactly who to blame.
I think there are lots of calls for more transparency and accountability because we are talking about a big pot of money and our economic driver. But yeah, we'll just see how this plays out and whether the governor can strike a balance with that board and how we market ourselves to the world.
Yeah, and I think that the marketing should touch on what we have to offer in terms of the sciences, the business, the university. Those are assets that people maybe are not aware of because the marketing of Hawaii as being sand and sea and sun has been so dominant that they don't have a more accurate image of what Hawaii has to offer.
Any other final thoughts just about the time that we're in and going forward?
I thought that the Hawaii Visitors Bureau had done a good job marketing Hawaii. They had established branches in Tokyo, in Europe, that don't exist today. Marketing of tourism involves many things, but nothing like person-to-person type of contact to convince people or to sell Hawaii tourism to people in other countries. One last note. You know, what I'd like to see is the HTA make a direct plea to the Canadians to come to Hawaii. You know, none of the states have done that, and the nation has lost, I think, $12.5 billion so far in tourism dollars. I think that now people may be afraid of Trump. The hell with that. Just go ahead and say to the Canadians, listen, we have differences with our president. We'd like you to come to Hawaii.
That was former Governor Ben Cayetano, who we spoke with this morning. And we will have more about the Hawaii Tourism Authority coming up after a break. Rick Eggett was head of the Office of State Planning under Governor Ben Cayetano back in the 90s. He's now the head of the Waikiki Improvement Association, so he brings that long view to the table. We sat down with him in his office at the Waikiki Business Plaza yesterday. Eggett is optimistic about building on the last 27 years of the work accomplished under the HTA.
So the HTA was created to be a separate, independent organization. It was attached to DBED because it has to be attached to something, but the idea was it would be separate and independent. They created a special fund for it. They increased with the agreement of the tourism industry. I mean, we were all working together on this. The tourism industry was at the table. Unions were at the table. We wanted to take our tourism presentation to a much more sophisticated level. We wanted to get away from sun, sand, and surf. We wanted to get to the point where we were showcasing Hawaii's culture, all the different parts of Hawaii, and particularly the neighbor islands. We wanted to increase the positive impact of the visitor industry on the neighbor islands. And so that was the goal that was behind the creation of HTA. And I think that it in many ways, it was very successful in doing that, created a worldwide marketing effort that focuses on individual marketing areas. It has really brought forward the whole emphasis on Hawaiian culture and the fact that's what makes us different than the rest of the world. And it's certainly illustrated in the fact that we have so many Hawaiian tourism leaders at the moment. And so I think we've come a very long way, and HTA played an important part in accomplishing that. But I think that the model of HTA that was created back by the ERTF, it really ended up being very dependent on having strong and visionary leadership. And so you can't always guarantee that the person that gets selected for that job has all those qualifications or is going to be able to result in that kind of leadership. So I think that the current idea behind the HTA is to bring it more within the state government and allow the governor and the legislators and the DBED director to have a much more positive impact on that tourism message that is portrayed. And so I'm very optimistic that this idea will work and make Hawaii's tourism effort that much stronger.
And we have to stop and think, because it wasn't that long ago that we hit 10 million and everybody was a little concerned because of the feeling globally about over-tourism and whether we were going in the right direction and whether there ought to be more emphasis on management and the quality of the story that was being told. And I can say that because I just came back from a trip and it was just very interesting to see how uneven their storyline was. And it made me appreciate coming back here and knowing what work has gone into improving the message and getting the authentic Hawaii out there. And like you said, get away from just sand and sun.
I think that it's still a work in progress. I'm not claiming that we've accomplished everything we hope to see come out of the Hawaii Tourism Authority, but we've come a long way. Where we are today is a much better place than where we were back in 1998. And in that regard, I think that we have to continue to develop that. One of the things HTA started was destination management plans. Each island has one. And so I think that where they probably fall a little short is I think they need to be more active. And the whole idea is we want to direct 10 million visitors plus is a lot of visitors. So the way we make that work for us is we get the visitors to go where we're set up to handle them. We set up certain areas to handle visitors and more visitors, and that funding has to go into making certain parks places where you want visitors to go. And so the idea that the management piece of this is really critical, and so the funding for the development of tourism shouldn't just be in marketing. It should also be in the infrastructure that is required to be able to handle those tourists locally. And I think that HTA began that, but that job is by no means finished.
And there was, I think, probably some criticism that maybe too many industry interests were rising to the top versus community concerns. How do you view that, finding that balance?
I think that's got to be one of the roles of these destination management plans, is to include the community's concerns and then, again, make sure that we are directing our visitors in the areas that we're set up to handle them. Because, yes, tourists can be disruptive. It's if they're just running around willy-nilly. We want to have a plan. We want to know where those visitors are going to go and be prepared to handle them.
We went through the whole thing with Airbnb and how that just exploded, and we were getting the pushback from folks in the neighborhoods and the concerns about housing. And I think a lot of that has been reined in, I think.
No, I don't agree.
No, okay.
I don't. I think although we have the laws in place, those vacation rentals are still way too pervasive. I guess there's some question about the counts, but by any accounting, there's somewhere around at least 10,000 of them in our residential community on Oahu. Think of that in perspective. We have about 30,000 tourism units, hotel rooms, condo hotels, blankety blank. Another 10,000, so in other words, a quarter of all of our places that tourists are going are these illegal vacation rentals. That is still a huge problem and still needs to be reined in. The city is working at it, but they're giving out citations in the 10s and 20s, and it's just scraping the tip of the iceberg of that 10,000 vacation units within our residential community, taking up spaces that should have residents in them.
I know on my street, that number is down.
So
I'm appreciative of that. So anything else that you want to underscore as we just consider what the intent was, and now it's come full circle and we'll be back under DBED again?
Yeah, I think that the intent to be able to expand our marketing into more of a world-class destination rather than just the sun, sand, and surf that features our culture, features our geographic attractions, if you will, which is more than just the beach. We have all kinds of great, wonderful parks. We have historic places. We have the volcano. There's a lot going on in Hawaii that visitors come to see. In fact, I just saw a survey. What places do you want to visit? Asked people in the United States, and Hawaii was number one. So we're still up there. I think we tend to be a little hard on ourselves. And hey, yeah, everybody makes mistakes, but I think the direction is still solid. And I think we can do a better job of keeping that on track and moving forward. And all the players are there now. Like I mentioned earlier, we have some really dynamic Hawaiian leaders that are taking us to a new direction in terms of being able to integrate our visitor industry into our local culture. It's really, I heard somebody say, they have more to learn from us than we have to learn from them, which is true. So I think that ability to share our Hawaiian culture with our visitors, that I think is one of the hidden treasures of Hawaii. Maybe it's not so hidden, but the idea is that really needs to be a strong part of our presentation.
And so hopefully under this model, we can work on those aspects and try and keep everybody happy.
Well, of course, there's always a question of how do you do that? And look, I work in Waikiki, so I see our visitors every day, and I see what they're doing. And you can't just tell people, oh, no, you should do this or you should do that. You have to create the opportunities and let people make a choice. And my concern is that we make sure that we give them the options that are going to benefit not just our visitors, but our community as well.
Because the lawmakers tried to defund HTA a couple of years ago, anything else that you want to emphasize?
What's important to realize is that there are all these great programs that HTA has funded over time. And when you talk about defunding HTA, you put all these programs with thousands of our local residents involved in that, in particular their cultural programs, you drive them crazy because they don't know if they're going to have the money to do what they need to do next year or next month. And so it's important to realize that it's not HTA you're hurting by saying, oh, we're going to stop funding. It's all the programs that they've put in place. And so when you do that, I think it's important to realize, important to do it in a fashion that can make sure that we have continuity for all the great programs that HTA has helped put in place over the years. And that's what kind of causes a lot of consternation within the community. And it's the opposite, I think, of what the legislators want to do. I think they want to have HTA do more of those kinds of things, but it has to be done surgically as opposed to with an axe. From what I know of the governor and what I know of Jimmy Tokioka, who's at DBED, they're very much aware of these things and I think are very concerned about making sure that we're moving forward, building on the good things. And if we've had some things that were less than successful, then we change direction in those areas. Mm-hmm. It's something where we need to work together as a community in this effort. And don't forget the old saying, throw the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, you know, we want to change HTA, but we want to build on the good things that have been created under HTA.
That was Rick Egged, president of the Waikiki Improvement Association, talking about the past and future of the Hawaii Tourism Authority. A law to regulate mamaki tea goes into effect today, despite worries that it will hurt, not help the industry. Some expected the measure to be vetoed by Governor Josh Green after farmers and tea makers voiced concerns that the bill went too far in regulating teas and tea blends. So when the governor signed the bill into law on Friday, the move surprised many, including Department of Agriculture Director Sharon Hurd. She spoke with HPR's Mark Ladau about her department will spend funds for an inspector that were allocated in the new law.
I don't know why the governor decided it was a surprise, but from my point of view, I was asking for the bill to be signed because the inspector position that was in that bill was really important to the department to be able to enforce the ahi provision, as well as the mamaki provision, as well as the coffee and mac nuts law that were passed last year. We want to be able to enforce it. We need bodies. We need bodies to do that. The need for inspection has increased without an increase in the staffing. So as we were moving through this ledge session, there was no provision for an inspector. And we were at the Department of Agriculture and Biosecurity now, were worried about how are we going to implement these new laws. It was the Mamaki bill that would have been the one that needed the inspector, because there's so much more people in the tea industry that we would have to inspect. And that's the bill that was on the veto list. So we were kind of in a panic, like that's the one that has the inspector. And then it passed. So maybe the thing that moved it over the finish line was the request for the inspector. And if it was, then we're happy because we do need the inspector.
And tea producers were perplexed. Some say the new law is already affecting business. Byron Gu is the owner of Tea Chest Hawaii. He spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender yesterday.
When the governor put the bill on the intent to veto list, it really felt like a community win. It felt like stakeholders on all islands, including the mainland and in Japan, they felt like somebody heard them, like what they felt, what they thought was the right thing to do mattered. So when he ended up signing it anyway into law, it really felt like a gut punch, like we got to the goal line and then we fumbled, like we didn't get the job done. Yeah, it was really concerning.
And we've talked before, we've had people on the show talk about why they felt like that law was too broad brush in how it went about labeling. But how did it get so far into the process, being what people in the tea industry felt like would be an issue on the regulatory side? How did it make it into law?
I don't know the, you know, behind the scenes things. I don't know how these things got written up. I don't also know of any one person or company that testified or went to the ledge and said, I think we need this. I think the term industry was used too loosely because we are not an industry yet. This law literally goes into effect tomorrow, July 1. It's signed on Friday. Now, I know there's issues around enforcement, policing, all that, and that's a whole separate can of worms. But if we truly were an industry, I cannot imagine the governor doing this to, let's say, the tourism industry. Like all of a sudden, they have to collect more taxes, or the airline industry, landing fees go up, shipping industry, right? You can't do something on Friday expecting the industry to pivot on Tuesday. So I do think that it shows that it's still a trend. It's a young, upcoming, burgeoning crop. I think the other confusing part is that they think of it only as tea, but mamaki has all these different uses, and it should be treated as a crop. It should not be treated as a finished good. Yeah, so there was a bunch of issues that called us on the mat and said, hey, look, I think we need to discuss this.
What are you folks going to do now that this is going into effect?
I think good policy clarifies things instead of creates uncertainty. You know, small businesses, including ours, one, we're just coming out of COVID. Two, we're surviving the gut punch of the Maui fires, right? And what it did to tourism. Three, you know, we're dealing now this year with tariffs. How much can we absorb versus how much do we have to pass on to survive? In addition to all the structural stuff, the labor cost of doing business going up, et cetera. So to have one more uncertainty given to us at this time does not help the industry. Today, I've had calls from customers spooked that, hey, do I need to take it off my menu? Do I need to pull it from my shelf? And then for me personally, do I pay for that? There's so much uncertainty in the language. That's why we fought it. I think if the governor moving forward today, tomorrow, whatever, if he can issue us something in writing, or the chair of the Department of Ag can issue something in writing stating clearly that the intent and the enforcement of this labeling law applies only to the mamaki content in any kind of product, that would be good. That would help people move forward.
So I guess in concrete terms, what would be an example of the kind of change you think a company like yours might have to make?
That's a really good question, Maddie. I think that's a bigger issue. That's above my pay grade. I think what didn't help this bill get more broader acceptance is it it kind of muddied the water and it kind of pulled two separate issues together and tried to address it in one swoop. We are all for truth in labeling. For example, where does this product come from? Where is it grown? Things like that. We're all for truth in labeling, okay? But this law also kind of, it tried to tackle the Hawaii grown scenario, right? There's already Hawaii revised statutes around the legal definition of what products are made in Hawaii and what are not. I think if we continue along this line about going after food security, growing more of our food, creating more ingredients from the aina or the ocean or whatever, I think we're probably going to need legislation around what is Hawaii grown, raised, farmed, et cetera. I would like to see that dealt with at the federal level. If we can get a Hawaiian appellation designation, similar to French wines, cheeses, Indian tea, if we at the federal level can get something enforceable that says this is Hawaiian, and in order to use the term Hawaii, Hawaiian grown, Hawaii, on your label, this is what the definition is, that would help everybody.
Is there anything else that you want to add or you want listeners to know?
I think mamaki is a great godsend. It has the potential to be a crop that, you know, it's culturally relevant, right? There's history. There's millennia of history. It is caffeine-free. It's healthy. It's an adaptogen. It checks a lot of boxes. People ask me, hey, what's the definition of, you know, when is mamaki going to be mainstream? And I said, well, when, you know, maybe Zippy serves it on their menu or something like that. But I hope this raises some curiosity about the crop, about the legislative process. And, you know, I hope they get involved.
We also heard from Representative Kirsten Kahaloa, who proposed the measure. She said the law will help protect local mamaki growers, and she criticized media coverage of it.
You could have a blend of tea, but we want to make sure the mamaki part of it is all 100% grown in Hawaii. But because of coffee labeling, there's a misinterpretation. So I don't think it's going to put anyone out of business. We need to tell people what the bill's intention is and what it's meant to mean. If you're calling something mamaki tea, that tea has to be from here. The 100% is confusing people. And so blenders now think blenders can't blend. If we need to make any adjustment, I'm open and willing to make language adjustments to that to make sure the interpretation is as strong as it can be. But this bill is not like coffee, where we're trying to get a certain part of a bag of coffee to be like 51% or 100%. That's not what it is. It's protecting the integrity of the tea plant and that integrity of it being a Hawaiian indigenous plant. It should be grown here and it should be harvested here and dried here. That's it. There are a lot of mamaki tea farmers who are happy about this bill. And what I think the media has failed to do is actually give a balanced discussion on this topic. I think a lot of people have only talked to those who are scared about the bill versus those who really want to see it through and why it's important to them.
We have been hearing about a new law to regulate mamaki tea that went into effect today after the governor signed it on Friday. Look for more coverage on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, we're out of time, so that wraps it up for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to take a look at a federal energy assistance program that helps thousands of people here in Hawaii. The Trump administration is calling for it to be eliminated. Share your comments or questions about what you heard on our show by calling our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.